Thank you. This talk will be more focused than Lina's first talk. What I'm going to do is just to prove one theorem, which is boundary distance rigidity for the flat metric. This is a classic theorem. It's 30 years old, I think. And the reason I'm going to go through all the proofs is that the ingredients are used elsewhere. And it's important to understand some of them. So let me, there is a little overlap in definitions. I will repeat the definitions I need from Lina's talk. So first, I'm going to throw away all topology. So I will only speak about metrics on the disks, just to not to bother you with extra details. This disk is a Riemannian manifold. It's a clip, it's Riemannian metric G. And among all the structures on this space, I prefer the structure of a metric space, namely the distance function. The distance between two points is meaning the length of the shortest curve. And the length is measured with respect to the Riemannian metric. The boundary distance function is just the distance function restricted to the boundary. So its value at points x and y is the length of the minimizing curve between those points. And the question, boundary distance rigidity question, is can you determine the metric inside by this boundary distance function? So if you can measure somehow the distance between every pair of boundary points through the interior, I mean, the wave propagation time or whatever, then can you recover the metric inside? And of course, if you take this question too literally, the answer is obviously not. It just doesn't make sense to try to recover the coefficients of metric tensor because it's coordinate dependent. So it's everything is up to an isometry. And the isometry is a map, a smooth map from the disk to itself, which such that the pullback of one Riemannian metric by this diffeomorphism is the other metric. Obviously, this if two metrics are related by an isometry, then all boundary and the isometry is identical on the boundary. I will always assume this without saying explicitly. Then, of course, all boundary distances are the same because isometries preserve distances. So you cannot recover metric tensor. The only hope is to find it up to an isometry. And there is a term for this property. I mean, the ability to recover the metrics that can be recovered by boundary distances are boundary rigid. And what I'm going to prove, well, actually, I will try to explain the entire proof with almost every detail. It's very simple proof, actually. It's a theorem, which is, well, it's attribute to Gromov, but I suspect that it was kind of a popular result at that point, but Gromov's paper, Filling Riemannian Manifolds, is the only citable source of this. Actually, 2 years before that, a similar theorem was proved for the sphere by Michel. So I don't think it was something very terribly new. I mean, the Euclidean case, which is simpler than the spherical case. But anyway, the theorem is that the Euclidean, the standard Euclidean metric in a convex region of Rn is boundary region, which is, if you substitute the definition, it means that if you have a convex region in Euclidean space and some unknown Riemannian metric inside, and it turns out that the geodesic distance between every pair of boundary points is the same as the Euclidean distance, then the metric inside is isometric to the standard Euclidean metric. Isometric in the sense that there is a diffeomorphism that sends the flat Euclidean metric to that unknown one. So, Dima already told this, all this stuff, and another repetition is preliminary is about more general setup. simple metric is metric. Again, I always assume that everything on the bit, so no topological stuff, nothing. Symmetric inside is called simple if it satisfies two properties. First, I require that the boundary is convex. This is a technical assumption. Everything can be worked out without it. But let's assume this. Convex means that when you measure the distance between two boundary points, like here, you always get a length of a geodesic, which doesn't graze along the boundary, doesn't touch the boundary at any point. No, nothing like this is allowed, so it makes things much easier from analytic point of view. And the second condition is that all geodesics are minimizing, and there are no conjugate points, which means that every geodesic segment is a smooth function of its endpoints, essentially. So you cannot have something like this, two minimizing geodesic between two boundary or non-boundary points. On the picture you have, I draw two boundary lines. This is not allowed, and these two conditions imply that everything is filled by minimizing geodesic. So measuring boundary distance function, you're actually measuring the length of all geodesics that you have in your space. So there is a hope that metric can be recovered. As Dima explained, if you don't assume this, it may happen that some regions inside this disk just invisible from boundary distance function perspective. You can penetrate it by some geodesics, but not by minimizing geodesic between boundary points. So that's there's a natural class of metric to ask boundary rigidity. And simple but very important observation is that you can detect simplicity by looking at the boundary distance function. So if two metrics, well, let's say on the disk, have the same boundary distances, boundary distance function, then either both are simple or both are not simple. How to prove this? Convexity of the boundary is detected by local measurements. It's kind of strict triangle inequality for small triangles with points on the boundary. And if you know that it's convex, then the absence of conjugate points is equivalent to the fact that, to the property that the boundary distance is smooth, away from the diagonal, of course. So if it's smooth, then the metric inside is simple. And it actually implies the topology, the disk topology. And if it's not smooth, the metric inside is not simple. So it's very straightforward. And let me remind you the general Michel's conjecture, which says that all, it is conjectured that all simple metrics are boundary rigid, as Dima explained, told it's proved in some cases. And probably at early 80s, the most convincing fact was that if you have a smooth family of metrics with the same boundary distance function, then they are all isometric. So that was the reason. This is what Michel proved, and probably in his paper of 81, and this is probably why the conjecture is attributed to him. Now the next slide contains the complete proof of the Gromov's boundary rigidity theorem. Well, the proof is that three lines at the bottom. It's the entire proof. It's based on two very classic things. First thing is due to Santa law. And it's an interesting fact that you can find out the volume of the metric in the disk, of a simple metric in the disk, from its boundary distance function. So if it happens that two metrics, isometric or not, have the same boundary distance function and they are simple, then the volumes are the same. There isn't just an explicit formula which one can write down in terms of boundary distance and its derivatives, up to second order, I guess. Well, and the second...
What happens if you try
the garbage. Just garbage. You cannot differentiate it first.
Yeah.
It includes the derivatives, second derivatives. No. Well, you can apply it to non-distance function or to approximation. It doesn't make sense. It's not a volume. It's. The formula, if you write it down, it's not monotone with respect to this boundary distance function. So if you begin to substitute there some non-distance function, you get silly results.
You get some number,
but well, no, it's not a volume. It can be related to volumes of some subsets in some sense, but not the total volume of. And if you remove some parts of the formula and you remove some parts of the manifold, then probably you can relate one thing to the other. But it's absolutely nonsensical. Yeah. I will talk about it later.
I don't remember it.
Yeah. I'm planning to spend some time on this formula. And the second ingredient is Bezukhovich-Fearing inequality, which says the following. Well, Dima already defined what is a strict minimal Fearing, and Fearing inequality, Bezukhovich-Fearing inequality, just says that the flat metric is strictly minimal Fearing. And in plain terms, it means the following. If you have an unknown metric, simple or not, in that region in Rn, and it turns out that all boundary distances of this unknown metric are at least as large as for the Euclidean one, then the volume inside is at least as large as the Euclidean volume, with the quality if and only if the metric inside is flat, isometric to the standard one. Given this ingredient, the proof of rigidity is these two lines. Because suppose that unknown metric G has the same boundary distance function as the Euclidean one, then by Santalo formula it has the same volume, and by Bezukhovich it must, well, equal implies greater or equal. So you have this inequality. Its volume must be at least as large as Euclidean, and in the case of equality, they are isometric. So that's the entire proof. So my job is done. I proved the theorem, and now I will spend some time explaining the ingredients. I will briefly go through this Santalo identity and spend most of the time on Bezukhovich-Fearing inequality. So the original Santalo formula did not deal with boundary distance. It's a formula that allowed you to integrate arbitrary function on the manifold in terms of integrals over geodesics. It's a sort of integral geometric formula. So some definitions for that. First of all, I'm not going to consider the disk itself. What I want to look at is its unit tangent bundle. And the functions that I want to integrate would be on that unit tangent bundle. So, and to recover the volume, I will just integrate one, the constant one. So formally the unit tangent bundle is a set of tangent vectors of length 1, and the length is of course with respect to the Riemannian metric. On this space, the space of unit vectors, there is a geodesic flow, which is a map from a family of maps parameterized by real numbers. For each number t, you get a map from a subset of unit tangent bundle to the unit tangent bundle. It's defined by this picture. So this, if you take a vector, the tangent vector, unit tangent vector, there is a geodesic which begins at this point in this direction. You move the distance t along this geodesic and take the velocity vector at end points. So this new vector is the image of V under the map. The map is, the family of map is called geodesic flow. In compact, in without boundary, it's everywhere defined. If you have a boundary, of course, sometimes geodesic ends before the length of geodesic can be shorter than t, so it's partially defined. But anyway, I forgot to say that there is a natural measure on the unit tangent bundle called the Liouville measure. And this is the only natural thing that you can define on this unit tangent bundle. Every fiber, I mean the set of unit tangent vector at the point, is a Euclidean sphere, because the tangent space is equipped with the scalar product, the Riemannian metric tensor at this point is a scalar product. So the set of unit vector can be identified with a standard round sphere in Rn. And this round sphere carries natural volume invariant under rotation. Euclidean, and so this way you measure the n minus one dimensional volume on the fibers, and to get the 2n minus one dimensional volume on the union of fibers, you just integrate it over the volume of the manifold. That is Liouville measure. It's the only natural measure that you can think of on this space, and the classic theorem from dynamical systems, the Liouville theorem, says that the geodesic flow preserves this measure. So if you move a region, if you take a set of unit vectors of some measure and apply t times flow, you get a new set of vectors. They will have it will have the same Liouville measure as the image. So from measure theoretic perspective, if you equip this unit tangent bundle with Liouville measure, the trajectories of geodesic flow, I mean the image of a given vector under all Ft, form some curves. And locally, from measure theoretic point of view, the picture is just a family of straight lines with a product measure. Because if measure is preserved along, let's look at small piece of that, so they're all segments, no topological issues, it will be a product measure. So the integration by Fubini will give you that integral of any function over the unit tangent bundle, and I'm going to integrate just constant, is given by integration first along the trajectory, so along geodesics of our measure, and then by transverse measure. And what remains to compute is what is a transverse measure. And it can be computed at the boundary because our metric is simple. I assume it's simple. So every geodesic hits the boundary at some angle, and the cosine of that angle is the coefficient between transverse measure on this picture and the measure that we see from Riemannian metric. So this is the final formula for integration of functions. If you have any measurable function on the unit tangent bundle, and you want to integrate it against the Liouville measure, you can do the following. You integrate it over every geodesic, get number dependent on geodesic. From beginning to end. You parameterize the geodesics by the initial tangent vectors, so you get a function on a subset of unit tangent bundle, which is restriction, its restriction on the boundary, and you integrate it over this union of hemispheres at the boundary, multiplied by density, which is given by the cosine between the initial velocity of the geodesic and the normal vector. The inverse one will give you the term at the other end point. Oh, maybe there is some constant. Well, maybe you need to multiply by some constant. Probably yes. It all depends on normalizations of this measure. Maybe you're right that to well, for some reason I don't think. Let me think. Okay, so some constant is missing, either one or two in the formula. Well, this is not what I promised you. I promised you the formula in terms of boundary distance, but here the formula, okay, let's try to integrate one. What we have, this is the formula in what you get when you try to integrate one. To compute the volume, you compute the total uvial measure of the unit tangent metal instead. It differs by multiplying by some well-known constant, like the volume of the unit sphere in the Euclidean space. You integrate one along each geodesic, so the result is the length of the geodesic. And so then you multiply it by the cosine of the initial vector of the geodesic and the normal, and you integrate that over the set of initial tangent vectors. The problem is that this cosine, this initial direction, should be somehow recovered from the boundary distance function. This is indeed possible. This is a standard differential geometry. Yeah. Well, actually, it doesn't matter if it's a cosine or not, or two cosines. It is absolutely clear that the transversal measure is some geometric invariant of this original direction. Cosine or whatever, doesn't matter. It is some transverse measure which obviously depends only on the initial direction, relative position of the initial vector and the tangent to the boundary tangent plane. And why it's cosine? You just compute it. You just compute it and, yeah. Because it's,
You need G at the
boundary. Yes, you know G on the boundary from, if you know boundary, yes, you should know G on the boundary. And in our setting, we do know it, because we know boundary distances. And distances between nearby points determine your G in the boundary direction. Restriction of G on the boundary. Yes, you need to integrate over the volume n minus one remaining volume on the boundary. But if you know boundary distance, then we have this. So it's not a problem. And angles also not a problem because there is a differential geometry tells us that there is a first variation formula. So this is another picture, of a fragment of the same picture. We have a geodesic. We want to measure the angle between the normal to the boundary and the initial velocity. And what we have is only the set of boundary distance between every pair of points. Let's differentiate it. I mean, fix one point. One end point of the geodesic, move the other point, I'm moving x on this picture, along the boundary, and let's differentiate the distance, which is the length of this unique and smoothly dependent geodesic, as this moves. The answer that's given by differential geometry is that the derivative of the length equals the cosine of the angle between the original geodesic and the direction where we move, assuming that we are moving at unit speed. And if we are not, we have to multiply by the speed of movement. So differentiating this distance to y along all possible boundary direction at x gives you all the information about the initial velocity, including that angle with the normal. And if you never seen this first variational formula, probably you have seen Gauss lemma, which is a partial case, which says that if you have a family of geodesic emanating from one point and all of the same length, then the other endpoints moves orthogonally to them. This is obviously the partial case. And it's easy to derive the general case from this virtual one. So that's how Santala formula works, and this sort of here proves that the boundary distance of a simple metric determines the volume. We just plug in this expression of the cosine between angles to between two vectors into that integral formula and express this angle in terms of the derivatives of boundary distance functions. Then you also need to use this expression to recover the measure on the tangent hemisphere. But obviously this information is enough. It just identifies you this hemisphere with a set of endpoints of the geodesics, the differentiation, gives you everything. The final formula is quite long because you need to substitute this first variation two times in the coefficient, which is cosine, and in the density of the measure. It's not written here, it's irrelevant. I only need the fact that there is one. And let me make a little digression here. This entire formula allows to prove another boundary rigidity result, which is conformal boundary rigidity. So it's a different problem. I just spent a couple of minutes explaining that, and then return back to the original thing. So the metrics are arbitrary. I don't assume that any one of them is flat at the point, but I assume that they are conformal to each other. So one is obtained from the other one by multiplication by a scalar function. Then the boundary rigidity in this context, in this restricted context, is known long ago, and due to Mukhametov and Romanov, their proofs, well, the first proof was in dimension 2 by Mukhametov, then by the joint paper was in high dimension. It's completely unreadable by any geometer, because they are analysts. And geometers later translated their proof into this simple one. So the statement is that if they are conformal to each other, both simple and have the same boundary distance function, then they are they just coincide. There is no isometry issue here. If they are conformal isometric, then I just the same point wise, because conformal fraction. Here is the proof. It's an application of standard length area methods of differential geometry. What we do is we apply integral Santala formula to one of the metrics, let's say G. So consider all geodesics of the first metric. Gamma is one of them, of the picture of G. And let's integrate that conformal factor, lambda, against this geodesic. When you integrate lambda along one of the geodesic, what you get is the length of this G geodesic with respect to the other metric G prime, and gamma is, of course, is not a geodesic of G prime, probably, but it's one of the curves connecting the endpoints. So the length of G prime length of this curve is at least as large as the distance. So we have an inequality. The integral of conformal coefficient along every geodesic is greater or equal to the boundary distance between the endpoints. Now we plug this information into the Santala formula, and what we get is that the integral of lambda over the volume of G is at least as large as the integral of 1, which is volume of G. The Santala formula is applied to G, and what we integrate is a conformal factor. Then, by Jensen inequality, or Hölder inequality, by of course the nth power integrates to larger value than the first power. So the integral of the nth power of the conformal factor is also greater than or equal to than the integral of 1. And the integral of the nth power is just the volume of G prime. Because when n over 2, I guess. No, n. Because when you multiply a metric by lambda, by conformal factor lambda, you multiply its volume by lambda to the n. So we get a volume inequality, and we know from some type of formula that, or by reversing the argument, that this is actually equality. So Hölder inequality is inequality, so what we integrate was constant. So lambda is 1. That's the end of the proof. Unfortunately, it doesn't prove everything that Mukhamedov and Ramadov proved, because they also did stability estimates and other things. But at least it's a very nice way for a geometer to understand what's going on. Now let me return back to Gromov's boundary rigidity, and I'm finished with Santalo identity. And the next ingredient, the next major ingredient, is Bezukhoi-Schwilling inequality. This is a classic formulation, which was not about arbitrary metric, but about the metric on a cube. Assume that our domain, where the metric sits, is the cube. Coordinate cube in Rn, so it's let's denote faces. It has n pairs of faces, which I denote Fi and Fi prime. So on the picture we have two-dimensional cube. This is F1, this is F1 prime. And the eth pair of faces correspond to the eth coordinates in Rn. There is a metric G inside. And I want to estimate its volume from above. And the answer, the inequality, which is known as Bezukhoi-Schwilling inequality, is the following. You just measure the distances between each pair of opposite faces. I mean, the distances are in the metric space. If you substitute the definition, the distance between F1 and F1 prime is the length of the shortest curve that starts somewhere here and ends somewhere here. This is distance with respect to our metric between Fi and Fi prime. And you multiply them together, and this is a lower bound for the volume of the remaining metric. The equality, this would be identity if the metric is flat and this is a standard sort of cube or rectangular parallelepiped. And this is the only case of equality. If the equality happens, then the metric inside is indeed isometric to the Euclidean one. That's the Bezukhoi-Schwilling inequality. And what I'm not going to deal with this bunch of notations. What I want to have is a partial case. If all distances between opposite pair of faces greater or equal than 1, then the volume is at least 1. That's what I'm going to explain. Because the general case is absolutely similar, just it's some extra notation which don't fit in this slide. And observe that this is stronger than the filling inequality I wanted, right? Because suppose that the boundary distance function of this region of the square is larger than the Euclidean, then of course the distance between subsets of boundary is greater or equal than 1. So that's enough to prove this. And the proof is quite interesting because, well, actually I'm going to give two proofs if I have time. The first one is a classic one, old one. And the second one is that with that L infinity business that Dima started talking about. So the classic one, it's very sort of it's more elementary. What I want to do is I want to map, to construct a map from this cube to the standard unit cube, which is first on two, and second, it doesn't increase the areas, the volumes. If I have such a map, then of course I have the inequality between volumes. And the construction of the map is the following. Its coordinates, the map is called f, little f, and its coordinates are just distance functions of the faces. So the first coordinate of my map is just the distance to the first face of the cube. Cap it from above by one. So there could be some points where the distance is greater than one. In this, so I take the max minimum between the distance and the constant one. Well, the first observation, and I construct this function for every pair of faces, observe that f1 is equal to 0 here, because the distance on this face, the distance to the face is 0. And it equals to 1 on the opposite face, because here the minimum will be 1. The distance is at least is greater or equal to 1 by assumption, so that the minimum hits the 1. The first observation is that this map, so we have a map from this cube to itself. Well, it's better to think that the target is another unit cube. It doesn't make sense to think that it's the same one. So, to the standard unit cube. And the first observation is that it's on two. And here, the it follows from topology. Let me explain this in two dimensions on this picture. Look at how the boundary of the square is mapped. The left edge is mapped somehow to the left edge of the standard cube, because here both coordinates are zero. Here the first coordinate is zero, but the second one goes somehow from zero to one. So this line is mapped to itself, and the endpoints stay fixed. It's similar to this line is mapped to itself. The second coordinate is constant one, and the first coordinate goes from zero to one somehow. So every side of the square is mapped to itself, and the corners are mapped to itself. So this the map of the bound the square's boundary to itself is homotopic to identity. So it has a non-zero widening number around any point inside. And by Borsuk theorem or whatever Brouwer degree theory, it follows that the map must be onto. The same argument applies in any dimension. No, not induction. You just compute the degree. The same argument shows that the map on the boundary is homotopic to identity, and therefore it has degree one, and therefore by the degree theory it it is on two. And the second part of the proof is to see that this map is does not increase areas. Well, the only thing you need is that each coordinate function, which is a distance function to a set, is Lipschitz one function. It follows from triangle inequality. That's the only thing you need here, because any distance function in any metric space is Lipschitz one, in particular this function. Let me assume for a moment that all these coordinate functions are smooth. Then the proof is really easy. Since they are Lipschitz one with respect to the Riemannian metric, the gradients are unit or less than unit vectors. Let's compute the area by integration of G coordinate. Our map, we know coordinate gradients of coordinate functions, so we make out matrix of them at every point with respect to some orthonormal basis, compute the determinant, and the integrate the absolute value of the determinant. This is the area of the image of the image of the map with multiplicities by change of variables in integration. And since all gradients are units shorter, the determinants, the Jacobians are greater, less than, at most one. So the Jacobian of this map with respect to Riemannian metric is at most one, so it doesn't increase area, and it can preserve preserve areas only if the Jacobian is one, which means that this gradient must be orthonormal. Because, well, what I used is the inequality that the Jacobian is at most the product of length of gradients, and the equality is when they are orthogonal. So, and this means that the map is an isometry between our Riemannian metric and standard Euclidean metric, because gradients of coordinate functions are orthonormal. So the metric tensor in this, if you take them as coordinates, the metric tensor will be identity. That's a smooth case, but unfortunately the functions are not smooth in general, they are only Lipschitz. That's only thing we can know this, but fortunately for the purposes of this proof, Lipschitz functions are just about as good, just as good as a smooth map. First, they are differentiable almost everywhere by Riedel-Michaels theorem. This is standard theorem in measure theory or analysis, I don't know what, how this. Second, you can compute the areas of the image by the same formula, by integrating the Jacobian. Since the derivative is defined almost everywhere, you can, the set of points where all coordinate functions are, the entire map is differentiable almost everywhere, and at every point of differentiability you can define the Jacobian. So how the linearization of this map, what the linearization of the map does to the volume, that's the Jacobian. And you integrate it, and what you get is the area of the image with multiplicity. This is called area formula from geometric measure theory. Nothing surprising here. And the last thing that can be a little bit surprising is that you can define an isometry in this Lipschitz category. So isometry lemma is the following. Suppose that you have a Lipschitz map from one Riemannian manifold to the other, and suppose that its derivative is linear isometry of tangent space almost everywhere. This does not yet imply that it's an isometry, because consider the map from R to R defined by X maps to the absolute value. It has unit derivative almost everywhere, but because of this one single point where it's not differentiated, it's allowed to change it's not locally injective. But if you add the assumption that it's injective, or as I have written here, volume preserving, so there are no overlaps actually, volume essential overlaps between images, then it is actually a smooth isometry. That's quite, maybe quite surprising, but let me explain a bit why it's true. The main observation is that every map between Riemannian manifolds which preserves a distance is actually a smooth isometry. Because if the map preserves distance, it also preserves the shortest curves. And shortest curves are geodesics. So geodesics must go to geodesics, and they are smooth curves defined by differential equations. And you can actually measure the angles between geodesics, express angles in terms of distances. So it also preserves angles, And from this, it's straightforward to see that it's smooth, since it is an isometry in the standard sense. And to see that this error preserving, this Lipschitz kind of isometry must preserve the distance, you just compare some volumes. If you, for example, why it must be injective? If two points are mapped to one, then consider a very small metric ball here and here, because the function is the map is Lipschitz 1, they both will be mapped to a ball of the same inside a ball of the same radius. And here the volume is almost Euclidean, and here too. So if they overlap, you lose part of the area. And a similar argument shows that two points that are close together, so we have, it's injective, so it has inverse. And our goal is to prove that the inverse is Lipschitz 1. So it cannot squeeze two points together. That's the same argument, you just consider two metric balls around two neighboring points, and if the images are too close to each other, then the volume gets smaller, the volume of the union of two balls. That's very simple. And so you get the distance preservation, and so it's an isometry in the smooth category. This is maybe more interesting than this analytic stuff. Well, there is just one little final thing. It is that our original region is not a cube. I proved the filling inequality only for a cube. I want now to be able to convert the result to any convex region. And this is done by simple cut and paste argument. So suppose we want to prove the filling inequality, this is its formulation again, for this domain D. So given that all boundary distances are greater or equal than the Euclidean ones, I want to prove that the volume is larger. So what I do is I take a standard square, take a cutaway this region from the standard square. Well, let's rescale it so it fits inside the unit square. We'll take scissors, cut it off, and glue in a copy of this unknown metric. What it means to glue in? It means that I define a new metric space whose distance is, it's a length metric space, so path metric space, whose distance is defined as the length of, interim of length of connecting paths, and you can measure the length of paths, of curves. Well, if you restrict yourself to curves that intersect the boundary finitely many times. This is a metric space, and it's locally the metric to the original pieces away from this common boundary, which is irrelevant. And if you look at the proof of the Bezukhovich inequality, it didn't use any regularity. Piecewise continuous Riemannian metric was perfectly fine for that proof. It used only distance function and some local arguments. You can do it for piecewise metrics. You even don't need to glue pieces by isometry between boundaries. Bezukhovich inequality works in very low regularity. So you apply Bezukhovich inequality to this union space, and by Bezukhovich its volume is at least 1. Then you subtract this flat piece and get what we need. And that was, well, not much time left, but I will try to at least... That was the first proof. I promised that I will give two proofs. One is the classic... Yeah?
Are you using convexity?
No. Absolutely no. Convexity is just for formulation. So the boundary distance is a geodesic distance. The statement works for non-convex. I told you that there is no difference. It's a technical assumption to simplify things, just like the assumption that everything is a disk. You can work without this. You can prove Bezukhovich inequality for discless handles. I just don't want to talk about it. So, just like Dima, I will rush through everything he starts. So we hope that we will be able to explain it better some next time. So another proof of the same thing, the same. So my goal is again to prove feeling inequality for region in Rn. So nothing more. What is bad about this Bezukhovich proof? The bad is it doesn't extend far away. It doesn't generalize far, because it's unnatural. I artificially introduce some cube, some finite collection of coordinates. I just lost all the symmetry, every symmetry I had, even in the Euclidean space. It's nice short proof, but it's not very robust. So let's try it another way. Again, we have this, let's assume it's convex region in Rn, metric G inside, and the boundary distance of G is at least as large as the Euclidean one. I'm going to embed it into L infinity, which is universal space where every metric space sits in some special way. First, I need to embed the Euclidean space by a linear isometry, the formula for the isometry. So X is a point in Rn, and L infinity is L infinity of the unit sphere in Rn. So the image of X is a function on the sphere. And what is written here is that the value of f of x at point xi of the sphere is the scalar product. This is a very bad way to understand. Looking at this formula is a very bad way to understand what's going on. What's going on is that I think of L infinity as a small L infinity, Rn with L infinity type metric. Just there is not the continuum of coordinates. So every point of the sphere is one of the coordinates. This is, it's of course it's not formalizable, but this is how it's better to think about it. And in order to define a function from anything to L infinity, I want to define a family of coordinate functions. Well, and then look after some measurability and blah, blah, blah. It doesn't. Let's just define a family. And in this case, so actually every Lipschitz function from anything to L infinity can be defined in terms of a family of Lipschitz coordinate functions with the same Lipschitz constant. It's just, well, a simple analytic argument. And in this case, our coordinate function corresponding to the vector xi of the sphere, is a linear function of unit norm with level set orthogonal to this vector. So every vector, its coordinate function is a linear function corresponding to it. Obviously, this is an isometry because a map is Lipschitz, a map to L infinity is Lipschitz 1 if and only if, well, in some coordinates, some choice of up to zero measure, blah, blah, blah. Every coordinate function is Lipschitz 1, which is the case here. And for each pair of points, one of them actually gives this Lipschitz 1 inequality, equality in that Lipschitz 1 inequality. So this is the linear embedding. Then let's look at our metric space D with DG. Assume that we want to map it to L infinity so that on the boundary we have this linear map. And so that it's Lipschitz 1 elsewhere. It is possible. By our assumption, our boundary distances for G is greater or equal than the Euclidean one. So the map that we already have in the boundary is Lipschitz 1. And L infinity have this extension property, whose proof is written down here, but I'm afraid we don't have time to go through it. For any metric space and any subset of it, if you map the subset into L infinity by Lipschitz 1 map, it can be extended by Lipschitz 1, as a Lipschitz 1. And it follows immediately from the same property for R, just apply a coordinate wise, and for I it's just an explicit formula. It's a very simple thing. So what we get then, what we get is the following picture, finally. Here is an infinity. It's the best picture of infinity I can draw. This is a linear, finite n-dimensional linear subspace, which is the image of Rn, and it's isometric to Rn. This image of the disk with the metric G on the boundary is the same map. So it's some surface that spans this flat disk in this n-dimensional subspace. Now, assume that we have defined some sensible notion of n-dimensional volume in infinity. It's something that has to be done, but it's not very complicated. Then, well, if it's natural, then every Lipschitz one map should be volume non-increasing. So the volume of the original metric should be larger than this volume of this curved surface of the image. Then it's pretty obvious that the natural notion of volume, the piece of plane should be a minimal surface, an area minimizer. So we should have this inequality. The area, the volume of this F of D surface, F twiddle of D, should be greater than the area of this piece of plane. Because piece of plane and in linear space should be minimizing it. And that is exactly the Euclidean image of the Euclidean volume of the original disk, because on Rn the map was isometric, and isometry should preserve the volume. So obviously our notion of volume is same, and this is what is written here, and why all the inequality holds. So we need sensible definition of volume. Well, there are many sensible definitions of volume in normed space. For example, Hausdorff measure is perfectly fine, and it should be pretty obvious that everything works, except that when we first tried to find out a reference to the second statement, we found out that it's a well-known and long-standing open problem. So we had to invite some replacement technique, and that was what Dima told about. You need to replace, well, I don't have time at all, but actually we replace that L infinity structure with L2 structure. In this case, for this proof, we just introduce flat L2 structure in L infinity, and any Lipschitz map would be area non-increasing with respect to L infinity, and in L2, we are lucky that this is trivial, and you prove the minimality of linear subspace just by a projection. Here is a picture of a projection. So, I mean, orthogonal projection in L2. It's obviously contracts all distances and therefore contracts volumes. And if you want to analyze the equality case better, you can take slightly perturbed projection, which works like this, like on this picture, so that it strictly contracts the distance away from our target set, so that you can not only prove minimality but unique minimality. So everything which is not exactly that flat disk has strictly larger area. So I think that's it. Sorry for mess in the end, but at least one proof was quite complete.
It was projection.
How you